Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Joseph P. Farrell about his book, The Grid of the Gods. And as we mentioned at the end, it's co-authored together with Scott D. DeHart as well. And there's one thing I want to ask you about here in terms of the the sites that we have around the world. Yes. And this aspect that we have the node point, if you will, being the Giza pyramids. What do you make of the potential change in land mass, floods, etc.? Could we potentially also be talking about many of these sites still being underwater and maybe even covered or buried as well, Joseph?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. Graham Hancock did a wonderful study called Underworld about the sites off of Japan. We have the sites in the Caribbean off of Cuba that are clearly, there's just no way that they cannot be anything other than quite literally a sunken civilization. There's sites, as you know, in the Mediterranean with very similar features. There's sites in the Pacific Ocean. I think I even mentioned some of these in Grid of the Gods, where you have islands with roads disappearing into the Pacific Ocean and emerging on another island hundreds of miles away. Yeah. You've got all of this clear evidence that there was something that sank. And I think we have to look at the strong possibility, too, in our grid research, that these sites as well are placed and laid out with some understanding of a grid system in mind. What would be interesting to me is if we start studying these sites from that perspective, and to my knowledge, Henrik, no one really has. If we start studying these sites from that perspective, then the crucial question to be answered is, are they laid out on the same grid system? Are they laid out on the same pattern, in other words, that Carl Munk talks about or that so many others have talked about, or are they laid out on a pattern that would have been true for a very different surface landmass?
I think that's
quite the crucial question. Because if we're dealing, as is my hypothesis and my co-author's hypothesis, of some sort of physics being embodied in the grid system that we see on the surface now, then is it true of the system that lies under the oceans? This is yet another reason I think we have to slow down in our grid research and start taking some accurate measurements of these sites and surveying of these sites before we can come up with any real working hypothesis. The grid is there, and I think the physics is there, but we're going to have to lay out quite a detailed case.
Exactly, because, I mean, I don't know if surveying the whole, bottom of the ocean is the answer here, because it's just so vast, And we have different depths, and even the fact that we do have satellite technology, they're still finding new things down there all the time. I mean, just a few months ago, they found a kind of a stone circle slash, some people put the UFO thing in there in the Baltic Sea, for instance, and this is a random thing, that popped up. As someone was looking at some radar scans, I think, or maybe they did go over there with the boat. I can't remember how the discovery was made.
You mean a hinge-like structure under the surface of the Baltic Sea?
That is correct. That is correct.
Oh, my word.
Pretty interesting, huh? Yeah.
Send me the link.
We'll do. No worries. No, it's right here between Finland and Sweden, obviously, and it's a pretty interesting find, and we'll see if they go further. But my point there, obviously, was that if we could then use the other sites as a kind of a map, that should basically pinpoint us where to look right away instead of looking through the whole sea,
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think you're on to something there. My guess is the same as the implied hypothesis that you're stating. My guess is that we are looking at basically one and the same grid system. It's just that parts of it, for whatever reason, sank. And maybe, this is a wild speculative conjecture, but it may be that if we figure the grid system out, we'll be able to figure out why they sank.
Exactly, yes.
It's a fascinating, endless mystery, I think, that we're embarked upon with this grid system. And again, it's we have to slow down and start being careful and taking measurements of these places.
How long ago was the Cosmic War? And does that mean that the age of many of these monuments are close to that, or is there a long delay in between?
I think that's an excellent question. The working hypothesis that I used in the Cosmic War, Henrik, was the dates of the astronomer Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who put the dates for the planetary catastrophe and the asteroid belt at either 65 million years ago or 3.2 million years ago, or, and this is the key point, or harmonics thereof. And, you know, obviously when we're talking about length of time that long, we are obviously way, way older than any of the grid sites on the Earth. So connecting the two is rather difficult. And that's kind of the reason I've left all of this in a very broad, kind of open-ended scenario. We may be looking in some of these structures at things that are very, very old, but by the same token, I think you could possibly make a case that maybe Dr. Van Flandern's scenario did not happen as far back as he imagined it. We're really confronted, if we're trying to look at all of this as part of one all-encompassing scenario, we're really looking at three different conflicting chronological data sets. We've got the astronomical statistical data of Dr. Van Flandern on the one hand. We've got the archaeological evidences of Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson in Forbidden Archaeology, which span a tremendous amount of time,
yes,
from billions of years to hundreds of thousands of years ago. So we're looking at that data set. And then if we turn to the system of the grid, we're looking at places like Tiwanaku and Pumapunku in Bolivia, which are thousands of years old, but yet do not fit within either of the other two timescales. This is the big problem. And it may be that in my attempt to construct some sort of unified scenario out of all of this, that the chronological difficulties are simply going to be insurmountable. But on the other hand, I think that we do have to connect them for the simple reason that there are so many legendary, mythological, and textual indicators from the societies that inhabit all of these places that they should be connected. I think that's the problem that we all have to face, is,
yeah,
that the fourth and final part of the data set are the texts themselves.
That's
and
right.
What they're actually saying.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm you know, don't get me wrong here, folks. I'm the first to admit that there are huge chronological and quite honestly historiographical problems with trying to make a huge scenario out of all of this. And that's kind of why, Henrik, I've been trying to paint in very, very broad strokes in all of these books. I'm not trying to be like Zechariah Sitchin and get it down to a fine timeline.
Right. Yeah.
I just don't think that we're in the position to be able to do that yet.
No, it seems not. I mean, why would we want to try to fit every piece into the puzzle just yet? We don't have the majority of the data. I think it's so much unknown,
exactly,
still out there, right? But is there any of these?
Yes.
I guess four, you know, conflicting areas. The astronomical idea, the archaeological, the grid that you mentioned, and then we have the myths finally. Do you put credence in one more than some of the other ones here?
Well, I don't place more credence in one or the other, Henrik. I don't think, on the one hand, that a purely scientific approach is justifiable. In the sense that you can ignore texts and what they're saying altogether. I think you do have to take into account local lore and legend and mythology and textual tradition. But on the other hand, I don't envision a kind of Sitchin-esque approach where texts become the controlling part of an investigation. I think you really have to walk a very, very fine tightrope of balance between archaeology and astronomy and lore and legend and text and so on and so forth. I really think you have to strike a very fine balance, and I hope I'm doing that, you know, but there are other researchers that will place their credence on one aspect of the data more than others. And I think until we know what the scenario is at this juncture, I think all approaches are equally valid. I honestly do.
Now, Joseph, you describe two factions, if you will, of this elite then who fought the Cosmic War. And yes. To make it simple, I guess in simple terms, you deal it up in basically the good guys and the evil guys. But who were
right.
Which faction here were the builders then of these things?
Well, I think probably both. And the reason why is that if we're dealing with a scenario that literally rips apart what had been an interplanetary civilization, both surviving elites are going to have to cooperate for a certain period of time. But I think at a certain juncture, you have the bad guys, so to speak, coming into prominence in certain areas. This is certainly the case in Mesoamerica, where you have the sudden emergence of human sacrifice in spite of the fact that Mayan and Aztec legends themselves come right out and tell you that Quetzalcoatl or Kukulkan, the chief civilizing god of those nations, expressly forbade the practice. So in other words, you do have clear indicators, and I even talk about this at quite a great length in The Grid of the Gods. You do have indicators in their own mythologies that at some point the bad elite staged some sort of coup d'etat and kicked out the good guys quite literally, mm-hmm. so that they could institute the practice of bloody sacrifice. What's interesting is that when you compare that history in Mesoamerica to what occurs in India, you find more or less the same sort of historical development. You have an initial stage where you have a what I call a topological physical metaphor occurring in the text. Then at a later point, you have the rise of bloody sacrifices, oftentimes human sacrifices. But in India's case, what's very interesting to me is you have a turn away from that again, with the rise of Buddha and so on and so forth, and the rehumanizing of Indian culture, mm-hmm. By the effect and influence of Buddhism. So,
despite the Kali cults down there and the thuggies and all that.
Yeah, that kind of drives those cults into a corner, whereas at one point they'd been rather widespread.
And yeah.
Eventually, of course, it gets rid of the idea of human sacrifice altogether in the Himalayas and the cultures up there. But it's interesting to me that development, for whatever reason, does not occur in Mesoamerica. In other words, they slip into this practice of bloody sacrifices, and they never get out of it, in spite of the fact that their own mythologies state very clearly that this was a practice not condoned or not sanctioned by Quetzalcoatl. So I think that's a clear statement or a clear indicator that you've got one elite prevailing in its views over another, for whatever reason. But I do tend to think of these two surviving elites of the cosmic war as being more or less the basis behind the esoteric tradition that you have a white brotherhood and a black brotherhood. I think this is the origin of that idea.
What about the aspect that human sacrifice then actually adds or feeds into the grid of the, I guess, the intention of those who brought it back in again, if we look at it from the point of view of the Black Brotherhood, right, and the human being?
Right.
Depending on what school of thought you take here, I know that you talk about Schwaller de Lubitsch in your book, for instance, and the aspect that a human being is more than just a physical body, obviously. It's part of this kind of the higher grid, basically, or the hyperdimensional aspect. So what do you think happens when human beings are sacrificed on these kinds of spots?
The answer is presupposed on something that my co-author and I are actually writing another book right now that we're trying to get into a bit of exploration of this question. But basically, let's presuppose, first of all, that there is an intimate connection between consciousness and the physical medium. And I think we're justified in presupposing that, given certain aspects of quantum mechanics, given the fact that physicists themselves are writing about consciousness and the physics of consciousness and so on and so forth. So let's presuppose that there's some sort of intimate, deep connection between an individual human consciousness and the physical medium. If that be the case, then you could actually go so far, I think, as to say that there is a group multiplier effect of human consciousness on the physical medium. You know, to recall the words of Christ in that regard, if wherever two or three are gathered together and, you know, in agreement, there am I in the midst of them. So in other words, even there in the New Testament, you have kind of an indicator that there's some sort of group multiplier effect. Now let's pretend, as the second supposition of this answer, that we are of evil intention and realize that there is this direct relationship between consciousness and the physical medium. Can we shock the physical medium, literally get it to do our bidding? The way that you would shock the physical medium, quite literally, along this very perverted line of thinking, would be to shock it through the consciousness effect, shock it through the spilling of blood, be it blood of higher animals or human sacrifice or what have you. I think, in all honesty, Henrik, this is a bit of the logic going on. Mm-hmm. There's also a second bit of logic, and Scott and I spent a whole chapter in Grid of the Gods talking about the idea of sacrifice and how it is inevitably, for some reason, connected with the idea of a debt that mankind owes to this or that god and has to pay it off, quite literally, through his death. This even, as we point out, enters Christian teaching. And we deliberately juxtaposed the Aztecs with a medieval Christian theologian in the Western Church by the name of Anselm of Canterbury, because in both cases, the mythology or the doctrine or the theology, if you will, of each group, both Aztec and medieval Latin Church, are that a debt is owed to the gods. And the implication in Anselm is that the debt is an infinite debt. So this becomes his logic, so to speak, if one wants to call it that, for the Son of God having to become man. Well, you know, the Son of God becomes man because God's infinite, but man is the only creature that owes the debt, and therefore you have to have a kind of a God-man in order to pay this infinite debt. So, you know, the logic is exactly the same as you find in Aztec statements of the fact that mankind owes a debt to the gods.
Yeah.
So I think that there is also, if you will, a kind of a physics or economics of the physical medium in play here as well, and that bad elite, if you want to call them that, are tapping into all of this for their own purposes.
Well, exactly. It's interesting. I'm thinking about some of the background stories that we hear from the Incas or the Aztecs about this is about keeping the sun shining. Basically, we're talking about that the human sacrifice is a kind of a stabilizing force in the equation here.
Yes.
You know, and the question is, exactly. is there actually something to that?
Well, if we go to the idea that these sites were laid out on the grid as a stabilizing machine, and if you get an elite that says, okay, I think what's really going on, in other words, is the elites practicing this human sacrifice know that the sacrifices are not stabilizing forces, but that's the story they're selling to the public.
Right, right.
But the covert reason that they're doing this is to quite literally practice what we would now call a form of black magic. They're trying to gain a power or an influence over the physical medium for whatever private purposes they may have. I think that's really what you have going on here.
And so the grid in this manner seems to aid their intentions then.
Exactly. It's kind of if you want me to crawl way out on a limb, it's kind of a thought amplifier
or
consciousness or emotion amplifier of some sort, and that's why they're doing it. It's interesting too. You know, the other question we have to ask is why does this practice seem to arise in various cultures around the world and then disappear mm-hmm. in some of them mm-hmm. and then reemerge. And it always reemerges in the context of a debt that is owed to some god. And, you know, that's another part of the story I hope eventually to get into, because, you know, when you stop and think about it, the idea that in order to forgive somebody you have to have the shedding of blood is really kind of nonsensical, because the last time I looked, I didn't need to go out and wring a turtle dove's neck in order to forgive somebody.
That's true.
You know? So we really have to question, where is all this coming from and why? What's the agenda?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that maybe then goes into this idea that the forces behind the cosmic war have in one way or another perhaps lived through, they have sustained themselves in us. We have these parts of them in us. This might even connect with these ideas that, a la Sitchin, if you will, then that we have in some way or another been genetically tampered with, and parts of them are in us, and we have this choice of, I guess you could say, then, between choosing the white or the black path. I don't know. What do you think, Joseph?
Oh, I think you're absolutely onto something there. I couldn't agree more with that. I think that this is a mythology, you know, the idea of these surviving elites or brotherhoods, depending on which angle of the tradition you want to come to. I think this is absolutely true. I think it's true at a multitude of levels, that somehow this survives in us, that we were tinkered with to perpetuate, quite literally, to perpetuate certain memes of social engineering. And to be quite honest, to keep us perpetually divided and in hatred of each other for silly reasons. You know?
Yeah, I know.
When it comes right down to it.
Yeah.
I think this was the agenda. I think that there's some truth to those Tower of Babel stories that constantly emphasize that in whatever state of primordial unity that mankind existed, in that state he posed some sort of threat to the gods. I mean, this is a theme all the way from the Vedas to Mesoamerica, and it's interesting that the solution is always to break apart that unity.
Yeah. Does it matter that mankind has moved away from the megalithic sites, or what does it mean when we have, if you will, then, Joseph, kind of new temples, Washington D.C., Paris, London? We have major cities here. You know, what do you make of that?
To be quite honest, and I didn't expect that question, it is a really good question. So I'm speculating here, but sure. I think, to be quite honest, that with places like Paris and London and Washington D.C., particularly Paris and Washington D.C., that are clearly laid out along the principles of sacred geometry and a kind of quasi-Masonic architecture, I think you are still dealing with some group that is still practicing this kind of geomancy that's represented by the grid.
Yes.
And they may even, I'll go so far as to entertain the idea that they may be a continuation of the elites that built the ancient parts of the grid. I don't know.
Yes.
But it is...
That's. I just want to interject that, because that's a very interesting point. We had Christopher Knight with us on the program, and he basically has detailed how the Pentagon is based on the megalithic yard that he and his co-author Alan Butler has written about.
Yes.
Is as a model of Stonehenge. So it's a new and modern, updated version of Stonehenge, Pentagon, which is like the warfare arm of the Western world, basically. What does that mean?
Oh, yes. Well, again, I think they're absolutely right, Henrik. And you know, I was going to add that, you know, this Masonic architecture, if you look at the lore of Freemasonry itself, Masonry has always made the claim to be a fraternity whose principles are traced back to the antediluvian world. Mm-hmm. In other words, to precisely this ancient very high civilization that constructed the grid. So none of this surprises me at all. The Pentagon, you know, we can go further. The Pentagon was built during the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemason and was the man that built the Jefferson Memorial to fellow Mason Thomas Jefferson, and on and on. Yeah. And on we could go. So, yeah, in this country, you are dealing, quite literally, in my opinion, Henrik, you are dealing with the fulfillment of Francis Bacon's Atlantis. Yeah. In other words, you're dealing with a country that was founded and deliberately foreseen by the then Lord Chancellor of Great Britain, that was founded, quite literally, to embody all of these principles. So there are deep, deep esoteric and occult workings afoot. I would be the first to affirm that.
Absolutely. It's amazing then how new modern sites, echo this ancient style of architectural design and all that. And we think that we, on some level, have left this behind. But really, if you think about it, Joseph, I mean, aren't we involved in one of the biggest, sacrificing schemes in the history of the world, considering the wars that are being fought over these,
The wars, it's not a very well-known thing, but the Supreme Court in this country, when it handed down the Roe versus Wade abortion decision, was prominently and overwhelmingly in the majority populated by Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, we are dealing with wars and sacrifice in a disguised fashion on a very, very large scale. And the wars in particular, I'm just not in the same ballpark as these wars on this war on terror and all the so-called justifications for it. I'm just not in that. I'm just not on that page. I think there's something else going on. I think it's very dark. I think it's very sinister. I just see no reason for human sacrifice, period, of any sort. And it upsets me immensely that it's going on and that so many people can't see it for what it is.
That's right. And so does this mean to you, Joseph, if we look at the larger context here, that the forces of the cosmic war right now is being controlled, if you will, then by the dark brotherhood? Is that where the situation we're faced with currently?
Well, I think certainly that the people trying to run things right now, Henrik, are not very nice people. They are certainly evil people. But I think they're also people in a panic. I can't look at what's going on right now, particularly in terms of the financial elites, and see anything else other than a group of very panicked, afraid people.
Mm.
I think part of the reason that they're panicked and afraid is that people all over the world are waking up and realizing that the playbook that they've been using for the past few millennia is not a new playbook, and they're sort of running out of new ideas. That's part of the problem right there. Excuse me, but I think there's in all honesty, Henrik, I think that there's another player on the block that they didn't reckon on. And this, I think, whether it be extraterrestrials or somebody here on Earth, I don't know. But they're behaving and acting like people in a panic and in a rush. That to me is the telltale sign of some sort of gun being held to their head. And I don't honestly know what it is.
That's right, and of course, some of this you've detailed in Babylon's Banksters, and that's an interesting continuation of that line of thought. But what if we go back a little bit, because I wanted to squeeze this in here, the comparison, if you will, in certain places here, because we primarily talked about Giza, Egypt, and South America, but we have tons and tons of sites in India. Tikal and the Madari connection. How about that one?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, what really interested me, Henrik, is that if you look, and I put a picture of the temples of Madurai in India, if you look at those temples and then look at the pictures of the temples in Tikal, the architectural resemblance to me is not only amazing, it's overwhelming.
Yep.
You have very steeply inclined pyramids with very, very crenellated, ornate corners and temples on top of them and so on and so forth. The architectural resemblance to me, Henrik, is overwhelming. And it points, in my mind anyway, and incidentally in another researcher by the name of Igor Vitkovsky's mind, it points to some sort of very, very deep connection between the Vedic culture in India and the cultures in Mesoamerica that built places like Tikal. And again, I think the connection, you have to go to the other connection, which is, of course, the practice of sacrifice, because it emerges in both cultures. So we're looking not only at a Vedic architecture in the least likely of places in Mesoamerica. We're looking at Vedic concepts that pop up in Mesoamerica in terms of Mayan mythology, and we're looking at Vedic practices in terms of the rise of bloody sacrifice at a certain point in their history. So the parallels to me, you know, when you look at it that way, Henrik, the parallels are more than coincidental.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of cultural connection. And the only connection that I can make in my mind that makes any sense is that you had an elite that traveled to the Americas from the Vedic culture in the subcontinent and made it here and carried with them their doctrine, their architecture, their belief in their practice. That's the only thing that makes sense. And of course, I realize that's heresy. I'm not talking about a land, you know, I'm not talking about a land bridge here, yep. You know. So.
Yep. Oh my God, they use boats, you know.
Oh my word. Yeah. They use boats and new navigation. Oh dear, you know.
Yeah.
But again, that's my point, because who first said that at the turn of the Renaissance into the modern era? Well, it was Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
And he comes right out and says it in a little book called The New Atlantis, that, you know, that navigation thousands of years ago was much greater than in his own day. In other words, what he was implying was that it was already known way back then that there was a global civilization with global navigation skills, and he just comes right out and says it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a interesting passage here that you have in terms of the Pumapunku mystery, basically, but then also mm-hmm. connecting that with Easter Island, and then later to Mohenjo-Daro as well in India as well. But there's there seems to be a bridge or a connecting point with the Rongo script of Easter Island. Can you talk about that
yes.
a little bit?
Yeah, the Rongo script is a very, very unusual script that is unique to Easter Island. And I go over the research of Igor Vitkovsky, who wrote a wonderful book called The Axis of the World, published by the same publisher. We've got the same publisher. And the Rongo script wasn't really deciphered until a fellow countryman of his by the name of Professor Schalek, from, I think it was the University of Szczecin in Poland, I think, or maybe Gdansk, one of the two, was a linguist that decoded the Rongo script, and he did so by pointing out the amazing similarities of that script to an 8,000-year-old script that you find in India in places like Mohenjo-Daro. So in other words, you have Easter Island way in the South Pacific, off the coast of South America, connected very clearly and linguistically to a world half an ocean and a continent away in India.
Mm.
So there is yet another clear indicator that whatever civilization inhabited India, it had a global reach. It was able to reach out thousands of years before it was supposed to be able to do that, and do so not over some stupid Siberian land bridge, but through the ocean itself. In other words, it was capable of sophisticated navigation.
So does this mean that we have the Indus Valley people, or of specifically Mohenjo-Daro, those people who were traveling over probably came to Easter Island, used that as a, I don't know, middle point, launching pad, and then went further over to the Americas? Or what do you think
well,
happened there?
it's Vitkovsky's thesis that, yes, Easter Island was kind of a launching point for whatever culture existed in India that gave rise to the Indus Valley, that gave rise to Mohenjo-Daro, that whatever culture was there also projected itself by, quite literally, by island hopping through the South Pacific, across the Pacific, using Easter Island as one of the jumping off points then to get onto the South American continent. But the problem that he's talking about is that this is an activity, if we take some of the dates suggested for archaeological sites in South America, this is an activity that goes back at least 30,000 years from circa 30,000 BC all the way up to about 8,000 BC when the Rongo Rongo script has been dated in its Indian variant. So, yeah, this is something that, again, is one of those chronological puzzles that, number one, it doesn't fit the Siberian land bridge model to begin with, and quite frankly, that model never made sense to me anyway. But the other problem is it's not fitting into any known age for the known cultures in South America. In other words, it's far too old. It's far too old. Mm. But again, you've got that weird statement by Francis Bacon. How would someone like that even know to say what he said in the New Atlantis? And again, the answer is, well, number one, he's a Mason. And again, it's part of their lore and teaching that their fraternity has secrets going back to antediluvian times. So, you know, it's yet another piece in a very big global puzzle.
That's right. So what can we say here a little bit about some of the other monuments or temples or even places, if we want to get to detail about it? Angkor Wat, Puma Punku.
Oh boy!
give us some of the tidbits, if you will, Joseph.
Well, Angkor Wat, it fascinates me very simply for the reason that it is kind of a stone monument to Vedic cosmology, and to what I like to call the topological metaphor of the medium that you find in so many ancient texts. And at Angkor Wat, it's particularly clear because you have the whole Vedic cosmology of the world arising out of a tug of war, quite literally, between snakes that are pulling themselves back and forth and creating this just stuns me to this day, creating this vorticular motion in absolutely nothing. And it's because of this vorticular counter-rotating motion of these snakes pulling back and forth that you get the entire physical world coming into existence.
Yes. Yes.
Now, what really grabs me about all of this Vedic cosmology is that it is so very modern. Because you have in certain versions of modern physics, you have the idea that, yeah, we're nothing but nothing of particular vorticular structure. So, it really grabs me for that reason alone. But again, the other problem with Angkor Wat is it is laid out on a precise 72 degrees east of Giza layout. In other words, it is in a precise position with respect to Giza, which is a more ancient site, again, half a world away. And I have yet, Kenrick, to read any archaeologist that can explain why it's there and why it would seem to be laid out in terms of a prime meridian running through Giza.
Yeah.
So again, you know, we're dealing with, very clearly, with some group in Indochina that is conceiving of this construction, this enormous construction at Angkor Wat, in connection to Giza. This means we're dealing with an elite that has a global plan, even that late in the game.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, to me, Angkor Wat, you could spend volumes talking about that place because it's fascinating.
It is. And 72 being a, you know, processional number, the zodiacal
exactly.
connection here. What's going on with that, do you think?
Well, everything. It's not only a zodiacal number, but as Graham Hancock, and I forget who his co-author of that book, his wife, Santa Faya, and then he had another person calculating the astronomical alignments of Ankar Wat. And again, this is really weird because Ankar Wat is apparently laid out to projections of the constellation Draco.
Yes.
And if I recall correctly, the projection was circa 10,500 BC. Well, why would you be building a monument thousands of years after that event to memorialize something in a constellation thousands of years before? And you find the similar date, if you've been following the work of Robert Bovall and Adrian Gilbert and Grant Hancock, for that matter,
yeah.
You find the same date memorialized at Giza. So in other words, to my mind, you're dealing again with somebody working on a global scale to build this huge global grid or global machine to memorialize all the same concepts. Now, Hancock and Faya in their book, Heaven's Mirror, I think it is, are hinting that these sites are laid out as some sort of key to immortality. We know not what, but this is, as they point out rightly, a constituent part of the lore of all of these places, that they all have some connection within their mythologies to the idea of personal immortality. I think that that's probably a significant clue, and that it has something to do, again, with the physics that they're trying to tell us in laying out this site. Again, I don't know what it is exactly. My co-author and I are working on a book where we're going to be exploring questions like this a little bit more, but I think Hancock and Faya, in other words, are on to something there. I really do. And, you know, I think they'd be the first to admit they don't know exactly what it is, but, but you know, they've pointed it out, I think they're correct to do so. You simply cannot ignore this aspect of all of these ancient mythologies either, and they're right to take into account the texts that speak of this. So whatever it is, I think it has to do with the physics. And
there is an interesting aspect here I want to talk a little, with you about here. If we have an influence from the Vedic, the Vedas, the Vedic religion, if you will, or mythology, over into the South American one, then we have an interesting aspect if we kind of, I guess, round up and end up where we kind of began in terms of the thermonuclear theurgy. You have something detailed here in terms of Viracocha and the three stages of the hydrogen bomb. And Joseph, to add on to that pile, I always were very, very interested in why Oppenheimer, after they tested the first atom bomb, and I can't remember if I talked with you about this last time, but he's quoting the Vedic scriptures, Shiva.
Yes.
Now I am become death. He's sitting there crying on a television. Yeah. What is that all about? Is he an insider? Does he know what is going on here?
Well, Oppenheimer was a Sanskrit scholar, and I think Oppenheimer was, I'll be very blunt, I think Oppenheimer was very alive and very open to the idea that the Vedic texts are talking about an advanced scientific civilization and culture. In other words, when he's quoting that, he's telling us that these people way back then knew all about this stuff. And, you know, for me, the clincher is that, yeah, if you take that Viracocha image from the Sun Gate at Lake Tiahuanaco in Bolivia and rotate it 180 degrees, it looks like a bomb.
Mm.
There's no two ways about it. It looks like a bomb, and it's a highly schematized thing, but nevertheless, you can, in my opinion anyway, you can quite literally see the three stages of a typical hydrogen bomb by looking at this thing. You've got an implosion detonator, you've got a secondary cylindrical device that you would find in a typical early 1950s hydrogen bomb. So yeah, you're looking, I think, again at some sort of very sophisticated culture that has Vedic roots, absolutely.
And does this to you mean also that we're dealing with an ancient warfare here on Earth? I know that the Sandhya, and this is an interesting connection, but the Sandhya Corporation were doing some work on one of King Tut's breastplates because this had some interesting glass on it. And Sandia, of course, were one of those who were mass producing the bomb at the time. But they were looking for evidence of ancient atomic warfare, basically. This is an old kind of idea that's been floating around. What do you make of all that? It's kind of a strange subject there.
Well, I make of it that they are looking for evidence of an ancient atomic war, and they don't have to look very far. That glass, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, that you're talking about on King Tut, that glass, if I'm not mistaken, is drawn from the Egyptian desert glass, which is an area of glass in the Egyptian Libyan desert that has all the appearance, Henrik, of looking like it was the fused silicate of an airburst detonation of a nuclear weapon of some sort, just like what we have in New Mexico in this country at the Trinity site where the plutonium bomb was tested. You've got all this green glass on the desert floor that nowadays is still slightly radioactive, but this green glass you find on King Tut, and it was highly prized. I found out recently it was highly prized by the Egyptians for whatever reason. But yeah, I think they are looking for this, Henrik, and to a certain extent that gives me pause, because this means that they're looking and reading these ancient texts in more or less the same way that I've been reading these ancient texts in the Cosmic War, and then that my co-author and I were reading the ancient texts in Grid of the Gods. In other words, they're reading them as containing a sophisticated mathematical metaphor and therefore as containing a sophisticated science and physics. And if they're doing that, then it stands to reason, Henrik, that they're going around to all these places and archaeological sites in the world and looking for the actual lost technology.
Yeah. Very interesting indeed. The Sandia National Laboratories, I think that they were also they were looking into this idea that the glass had been created because of a blast. And because that is an interesting other factor, because that actually might also, you know, connect with the cosmic warfare, that what produced this blast or another blast can actually have to do with the planetary, you know, explosion, if you will, of Tom Van Flandern. You know, this is the mammoth tusks around the you know, in certain areas around the world have been found with these microbursts and evidence of diamonds, if you will, or very, very sharp shards that have been blasted onto Earth. I don't recall how many millions of years ago, but I can't help to kind of connect these, you know, events, if you will, Joseph.
Well, yeah, I think you're right to do so. I think they are looking for these things. I think they've been looking for these things really since the Nazis first gave it kind of credence with some of their crazy projects. A lot of their projects were crazy, there's no doubt about it. But if you examine what they were doing, they were looking at these ancient texts and reading them with scientific spectacles on. And I think that process has continued. And obviously, places like Sandia National Laboratory, those are the places that are going to do it. And, you know, Oppenheimer himself, I think, you know, he gave the little clue that this is what they're up to, that they're realizing that we're catching up now, scientifically, in the last century and a half, to what these ancient texts are saying.
Yeah.
And that means that they have scientific content, and that means that these structures were not built by unsophisticated people just out to practice bloody sacrifice. There was a deeper, deeper thing taking place with all of this, and they're out to recover it. That there's no doubt in my mind.
And a final note on that, Joseph. Do you think that what they have found or what they will find is something that will be shared with the public, or are we talking about ideas that are connecting again with an elite few, and for whatever reason they might be actually trying to recreate the story for their own purposes? What do you think?
I honestly think, Henrik, that it will be something that they will try to keep to themselves. I don't know that they'll be successful, because there's too many people you know, as we discussed earlier, there's too many people waking up to their game. But I think in a certain sense, they have to keep it to themselves because, you know, and I've said this before on your show, when you're dealing with a physics that can engineer the fabric of space-time locally, you're dealing with a physics that has the potential to make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker.
Yeah.
And that's what we're dealing with. And unfortunately, this physics is, in a certain sense, much easier to engineer than a hydrogen bomb. And it's also much, much more deadly. So in a certain sense, the elite is faced with a proliferation nightmare. They've got to figure out a way that if they do let this out into the open, how do we prevent it from falling into the hands of, to put it very bluntly, into the hands of nutcases?
Right, yeah.
You know, that's their big problem. I don't think that it is necessarily that they want to keep this stuff secret, but that they realize that there's a dark side to it and that it has to be let out under very, very strict controls. I think that's their big problem.
Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting dilemma right there, because if we, I mean,
yes,
personally, I think that we the people who are in charge of it might not be the best people to have that power.
Well,
to
I agree
with,
there too.
This is the problem.
No argument from me.
I know. This is the problem. So to even think in those terms might be a misconception by us. But nonetheless, let's take it for what it is then, that they want to ensure the safety, if you will, then of all, or the planet, or, you know, because we don't know the consequences of this, the technology and the energy that this would potentially produce. We're talking weaponry and things like this. But
right.
Could that, I mean, just arguing a point here, could that be the reason why they are so incredibly detailed, if you will, about creating a control grid and a structure which is basically based on this idea that there is no privacy anymore? They need to have total transparency from their point of view into everybody's lives before they can actually introduce a new type of energy for transportation purposes, etc.
Oh, that,
is their behavior justified to some degree, do you think? Difficult question.
Well, that's a great observation, and I'd have to say off the top of my head, yes, that's one possibility for why they may be trying to do that. And not only that, Henrik, but I have to agree with you. You know, just because they may have concerns about letting this out into the open doesn't mean that these people are themselves a great group of people.
No.
They're not at all. I think really what has happened is that some of this stuff has been developed and it's not in their hands, and that someone else is using it against them. I think really when we get right down to it, that this is the problem that they've suddenly woken up to, that we're not the only players on the block that have this stuff. Someone else down here has it too, and they've been using it.
Yeah.
I think this is the real hidden motivation for this mad scramble to project Western power into every nook and cranny of the globe. I think this is the hidden reason. They're trying to find out who the dickens has this stuff and where they're based. That's my honest assessment.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot to that statement, of course, and that could be
analyzed
for hours, Joseph. But let's leave it for now and for another time. But obviously, we want to relay people further to your writing, and specifically what we've been discussing here today is The Grid of the Gods, the new book, if you will, from Joseph P. Farrell, together with Scott D. DeHart as well, but also in the series, obviously, The Cosmic War, the Giza Death Star series, obviously, and much more from that. And the website, again,
right,
here is GizaDeathStar.com, where you can find more information. Anything else now, Joseph, that you want to mention before we wrap things up with this time?
The only thing is that I do have a web store on my website, and if people have been having trouble ordering the books from my web store, that's been because of a problem that occurred with Amazon over the past couple of months, but it should be okay now that they can order the books right off the website.
Excellent, and I encourage everybody who are interested in these kinds of topics to pick up a few copies of Joseph's books, and of course the latest one here is called The Grid of the Gods. Really interesting work. And then you're continuing with new work, of course, together with Scott as well, and continuing to produce the books. Any ETA on the newcomers yet, or are you in the process of?
Well, I just sent off a new book that I wrote by myself called Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, and the subtitle is A History of a Breakaway Civilization. It kind of continues the Nazi series a little bit further. That should be out within, I'd say, 2 to 3 months. And then the book that Dr. DeHart and I are writing will probably be out next year sometime. And we wanted it to be out next year intentionally. So,
good call, yeah.
That's kind of a hint.
That's right. I got it. All right, Joseph. Thank you very much for today. We really enjoyed talking with you. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's our program for today. Stay inquisitive, stay open-minded, and please stay tuned to Red Ice Radio as we continue to bring you more exciting and essential material. Thank you for listening. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth at Red Ice. My special thanks to you as a member for making this program possible. Take good care, and we will talk more soon. Bye-bye.